Welcome to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast, where we focus on the people, the products, and the process of e-commerce selling today. Here's your host, Stephen Peterson.
Welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. This is episode 76, Charlene Anderson. You know, so fortunate that we're getting to talk to sellers with retail experience, because I think owning a business, owning a brick and mortar or retail business, a successful one, really gives you perspective about the trials and tribulations you'll run into as an e-commerce seller. Because when you haven't sold anything or you haven't run a business before, these things are new, these problems, this adversity, these challenges. But when you have a brick and mortar, you've dealt with customers and face-to-face and happy ones and not so happy ones. You've dealt with the inventory issues. You've dealt with the power issue. You've dealt with employees. You've dealt with all those things. And I think that's such great perspective. And Charlene has a background in there and just gives it such great value and giving you that perspective, and especially where she sold. I just think it's great, great, helpful stuff. Let's get into the podcast. All right, welcome back to the E-Commerce Momentum Podcast. And man, I'm excited for tonight's guest because I've been asked to interview her by, I think, four different people, which is pretty cool. I mean, that says something there. And what is really cool is I've been reading her stuff, people saying, hey, I saw Charlene Anderson speak, and I heard Charlene Anderson say, and I saw this, and I saw that. Hey, welcome, Charlene Anderson.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I mean it. Your name has come up more in the last probably 2 months than anyone else's to me. And names bubble up to me from other sellers, or you know, people request things or successful people recommend. And your name has come up many, many times. That's pretty cool.
It's pretty flattering. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you should feel good about it because it's all been very, very positive. So you are a full-time seller, and you've been selling for a long time. Not that you're old. I don't want to sound like that. I said that, Deborah Conrad. You're not old.
Because Deborah and I are about the exact same age.
So. All right. Well, you're young at heart. How about that, right? But you guys, you've been selling a long time. And man, I can't wait to hear about your brick and mortar business, because that was one of the cool things talking with Deborah, is the experience in that and then transitioning to an e-commerce, because it's different, you know, and it really is. So first, let's go back. What did you do to get into e-commerce? I mean, were you always a side seller?
I had a brick and mortar store in Honolulu. And then slowly as technology built up, I got really interested in the technology side of it. I just thought computers were fun. And then when eBay rolled along, I thought, this could be interesting just to get rid of junk, you know? And I started, like most people do, selling stuff I had around the house. I never thought of eBay as a business opportunity. We're talking like 1998, 1999. It was a way to get rid of stuff. And then I closed my brick and mortar store and I moved from Honolulu to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, which is a pretty isolated place. In many ways, it's as isolated as Honolulu was. And about that time, Amazon opened up their platform to third-party sellers. That was 2002. And that's when I decided, this could be a real serious business where I could live in a remote, beautiful area of the country and compete with anybody else in the world.
What kind of store was it in Hawaii that you had?
I had a yarn store, so it was for knitters and weavers and spinners.
So craft. I mean, these people had to be – they needed tools. They needed very specific things. And you're at the – really the beginning of e-commerce in 98 and 99, really, right? Wouldn't you say that?
Oh, definitely. That was back when eBay didn't require pictures on listings, when you could just sell pretty much anything, when people could leave feedback for other people, whether they had a transactional relationship with them or not, which was a
think
crazy
about that.
Time. Yeah.
That's crazy.
And the no picture thing was, when you think about it, you know, it's like, wow, I can remember selling an old hard drive with no picture, you know?
And you were – was most of your shipping going out of Hawaii, did you, back then?
Yeah, it was. That time, yeah. And I came into Jackson part-time in 1996. So sometimes I was shipping from here. Sometimes I was shipping from Hawaii. It all depended on where I happened to be at the time.
Now, why yarn? Why was there something there that interested you? Was that your thing?
It was. I'd always been involved in textiles my whole life. It was just something that it just really struck a chord. The handling the yarn, the making useful things with it and all that. And there was at that time no store like it in all of Hawaii.
Now imagine that. I mean, imagine, how many islands in Hawaii, and they all have to come to you to really find that merchandise.
That's right.
And, that's got to be incredible. That's an expensive boat ride to go get a, can you get me two rolls of yarn?
Yeah.
Two?
Or they could call up and I would ship it, because there's pretty much standard things that you would have and people would call up and say, I need this and that. And I would just ship it on its way.
And back then you were using like a shipping station, right? Didn't they, I remember, I don't know if it was FedEx or whatever, they had their own little dedicated computers and stuff.
No, I had a Pitney Bowes postage meter.
Oh, you rented that thing.
Yeah, huh? I did, dating myself, right? One of those clunk meter things at that time. And then I moved to a couple different postage systems because postage was the most, USPS was the most efficient way to ship most of this stuff. Then I moved into a web-based postage solution and then moved into Indicia, which has been the solution I've had for as long as I can remember now.
Yeah, I have Indicia. I still have it. Everybody's like, oh, why do you still have it? Because there are times I need it. There are just times when the other systems don't work, and Indicia always, always works on any device I have.
And it's a desktop-based app for Macs, which none of the others are, and I really like that.
Oh, okay. I'm not using a Mac. What, did you have employees in the store back then?
No, I didn't. It was just me. I really like that. Supervising employees is not my favorite thing to do. So I've consciously built my business so I don't have to do that.
So you really were trading time for money though, right? You were limited to the amount of money you can earn because you had to be there, right?
If you
took a day off, you got sick, you got whatever.
It wasn't open.
Would you ever, and I asked Deborah this question, would you ever go back into the retail brick and mortar business ever?
Nope, not at all.
You didn't even pause. It wasn't even happened. Nope.
I love the products. I love dealing with the products. I love finding products. I love all of that. But I also love making my own hours, working early or late, and then not working in the middle of the day or the evening or taking a day off or being able to go to Las Vegas for the ASD show, all that kind of stuff. So there's no question for me.
Now, living in Hawaii, that's a lifestyle, right? I mean, were you able to take advantage of it if you had a brick and mortar?
I did because I could set store hours as I wanted there. It was a simpler time. It was a far simpler time. So, I'm a certified scuba diver. I've windsurfed. Anything I'll do. Sports-wise, outside, I'll do it.
So now today, though, that still wouldn't be true, right? Because Walmart sells yarn, right? And sells some, or at least some of it, right? And so the competitive market would be so different. You would be tied to that business, especially if you didn't have a lot of employees.
Definitely. Plus, the internet has put huge pressure on brick and mortar stores too.
Right.
That you have to be there, and the time is the main reason. I would never do it again. Another is the location I'm at is that rents are sky high here in Jackson, just like Honolulu, and I couldn't make the money I make doing it online.
It's really interesting to me that you can still make that much money where you're located because you're in the middle of nowhere, right? I mean, you can drive and there's businesses and things like that, but it's not like you can just, go for 2 hours any which way and find, retail hubs. Is that correct?
The closest town is Idaho Falls, which is 2 hours in good weather, 3 to 4 if the pass is bad and all that in the wintertime, and that's our closest Walmart and our closest Target.
And then
the other two directions, two of the other three directions, there's nothing. There's Yellowstone National Park, which is closed in the winter except to snowmobiles and snow coaches, so there's nothing that way. South of us, 6 hours, is Salt Lake City, and that's what I would consider the closest city to us, and it's where we go a couple times a year to do big city things like Costco.
Okay, so you have to plan that, right? So you're saying monthly or every 2 months or every 3 months. So are you the customer, not you, because you obviously know the system, but are you the in the area where the customer will spend $6 for a box of cereal because it gets shipped to them from Amazon?
Oh, my goodness. Jackson is a huge mecca for Amazon sellers because we can't find stuff that most people take for granted, and people will pay to have it shipped. I know my neighbor is as bad as I am and has an Amazon package a day at least show up. And speaking with our area rep, he said 75% of their traffic coming into this area is from Amazon. That's mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling. And it's not like they're resellers. These are people who we're all selling to, right?
Exactly.
And everybody always says that. Who would pay $35 for pie face? Well, if you live in
Jackson Hole and you can't get to Target or Walmart, you are going to do it. I mean, we here, I can tell you, my neighbor does Subscribe and Save for baby stuff. She's a young mom and all that. She says then it just shows up on her door. I buy everything from laundry detergent to paper towels to dog food to shampoo. Pretty much everything the average person would go to their big box store for, I buy it on Amazon.
Would you also buy things that you used to like in Hawaii?
I try not to because the things I used to like in Hawaii are really fattening.
Oh, like, macadamia nuts and
chocolate
things like that.
Right. Macadamia nuts. That's the number one thing. I can't have it in the house. So there are some food products that are of a less fattening nature that I like, some barbecue mixes and stuff like that, that I still get through Amazon that come from Hawaii.
Are there, and I don't want to beat this horse, but I think it, no pun intended for the Jackson Wyoming, but it's just interesting to me because a lot of people are always saying, well, why would they? Why would they? And David Hawkins lived in Hawaii and he talks about macadamia nuts. That's how I knew that, mm-hmm. that's a hot item. Are there things that you had in Hawaii that you wish you could buy online?
Sunshine. Warm weather.
Well, you know what I mean. Is there a particular sauce or something like that? Because I think the lesson is that, you know, where you live, there was somebody who lived there, and there is stuff that's still not brought to market yet.
The one main thing is it can't be sold online because it's a donut product called Malasadas. Leonard's is the name of the store, and they make Malasadas, which are a Portuguese donut. And they're only good warm right out of the fryer kind of thing. So that would be the one thing. If they could, like, teleport those to me, I'd be happy to camper.
Okay. What I want to do is take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about how, you know, selling in Hawaii is different than selling in Wyoming. And then how you grow to such a large business in the middle of nowhere. I'm really interested in that. We'll be right back. All right, it's early in 2016. You just came off a slamming fourth quarter 2015. You're sitting on a boatload of cash and you're thinking, I want to do something for my business. I want to grow. Start looking at an end foundation. Look at them as building blocks. Build, build, build. Change your categories. Think about gated categories specifically, shoes and clothing. YourSourcedInventory.com, that's what they focus on. You'll get a list every single day of the week, Monday through Friday, and they're going to give you leads for about 10 items that are in the shoes and clothing, and even dipping into the sports and outdoor category, which is great. These are all gated categories. Listen to some of these ranks. In October, the average shoe rank was $7,571 for $29 profit, a return of investment of 88%. December, 11,000 ranking, profit of $32, 83% ROI. Think about that. Profit of $32. What's your average selling price? Imagine what your average selling price would jump to. In clothing, ranking in October, $6,800, profit of $1,488. But listen to this, ROI of 109%. What could you do to get that 109% return? You got to join YourSourcedInventory.com. We use it as foundational in our business. We think you should too. YourSourcedInventory.com. In this segment, we really break down Charlene's business, her experience, her coaching program, which I think what I really liked about talking with Charlene, she is no nonsense. I mean, she is helpful. She is to the point. She will help guide your business. And it's a very inexpensive coaching program as coaching goes. And I love the fact that it's a more of a friendship kind of thing. I mean, it's just so neat to see the interaction go on. And I think that she can help a lot of people. And I think, you know, when you're thinking about a coach, it's so much about getting along and buying into the program. And what I really appreciate it with her is that she clearly has a following. As I say, she was the most requested person that I interview in the last month. I mean, I probably had six people say, Steve, you have to ask to get her to come on, because I want to hear what she has to say. And she delivered. Very impressive and very, very cool. Very cool. So let's get back into the podcast. All right, we're back and we're talking with Charlene Anderson in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, which is a big tourist area, is it not?
It's huge, yeah. We are just a few miles south of Grand Teton National Park and about 60 miles south of Yellowstone National Park. So it seems once in their lifetime, everybody comes through here to do that whole tourist thing.
So you probably have a lot of boutique shops and things like that.
We have a lot of t-shirt shops, a lot of art galleries. That's probably our biggest by number of shops is art galleries, believe it or not. People come here to buy art. People come here to see the scenery, and they want, you know, images, whether it's photographs or paintings of what they've seen. We have a fair number of little tchotchke kind of stores that sell a little bit of everything like most tourist area has. And we have a lot of restaurants here, too.
And they're open all year round?
Most places take a break in April and October because it's not warm enough to be nice for visiting the parks, and it's not cold enough to be skiing yet. So those are kind of the little shoulder seasons. And most restaurants will close for a couple weeks during that period. But our grocery store stays open. A lot of the, you know, the normal things stay open, but the restaurants do kind of take a break.
So how do you take when you moved from Hawaii to Wyoming, were you in Amazon yet, or were you, I know you were in eBay and you're still in eBay, so that was easy. But was Amazon ready then or no?
I bought my first property here in Jackson in 91. Moved here in 96, so Amazon was not a player here yet. Amazon, I believe the first year they had third-party sales was 2002, and I looked back, and that's when my first feedback was on Amazon, so I'm guessing it happened about that time. And we could only sell books for a while. You know, that was all you could do, books.
You were way out before FBA had started.
I was, many years, probably 6-7 years before FBA started.
And you were selling books, and then did you gravitate into CDs and then DVDs as they became prolific?
Stayed with books until FBA opened.
Oh, really?
And then once FBA opened, all the contacts I had from my brick-and-mortar days, I called in all those, found a whole bunch more, and just started selling similar things to what I'd had in the brick-and-mortar store, basically arts, crafts kind of things.
And so you were in the beginning stages of watching that business move. Did you sell the business in Hawaii? Not to get too personal.
No, I just closed it.
Okay. I was going to say, did it survive as the internet came out and became the e-commerce world?
I don't think that there is a similar store there to this day. It's been a couple of years since I've been back, but I don't think there is. It's just the numbers just don't work there. You know,
okay.
There's a million people on Oahu, but those who do yarn-like things are somewhat limited.
And they would be able to buy them online. Well, and let's talk about that. So you've gotten to see the business that you knew so well, and you knew what would sell. Is it different today?
The trends change, and just like anything, they change on a cyclical basis. But the foundation is still there. Everybody needs knitting needles. Every spinner needs a spinning wheel. Artists need paints and paintbrushes and paper. So those basics are there. Within those basics, there are trends that you really have to be on top of so you know where to point the ship for the next year.
Because it would have changed, though, anyway, even in the brick and mortar.
Exactly.
Is what your point is.
Exactly, yeah.
And what would you have done with that inventory in the past?
You mean from the brick and mortar?
Yeah, you would have had stale inventory if you overbought, right? Because that's the hassle you have to buy, and there's such a long lead time, I'm assuming, there.
Yeah, when I closed the store, I just had a going out of business sale and sold everything.
Okay. So it's a little different now managing inventory, because you could carry very little FBA inventory
as little as you want, because the lead time to get it is probably pretty quick relative to back in those days.
Definitely. Though I have to say, shipping from anywhere in the U.S. to Jackson is a week, unless you're shipping,
wow,
you know, overnight or 2 day. Even my 2 day prime is 3 days the vast majority of the time. So even though we're sort of centrally located, we add an extra zone or two to get stuff here. So I can actually have stuff sent from one of my suppliers in India and it'll get here in 2 days, but I can't get something from Southern California in less than a week. I find the irony is just amazing.
That makes no sense, right? So you're not using a prep company. You're prepping everything yourself.
I do it all myself.
Do you co-mingle?
No, never have.
Okay, so you're labeling everything.
Yeah, labeling. Interestingly, a lot of the stuff in the arts and crafts world does not have barcodes. So using a prep service or having Amazon label is a whole different kettle of fish. You know, you need to train people specially, and it would probably cost a lot. I'm really efficient and really fast at doing it because these are products I've handled for 30, 40 years. You know, I know them. I do have a couple suppliers send direct to Amazon and
okay,
just have Amazon label those in the instances where it makes sense.
Do you have to create your own list? I guess you would have.
I do,
right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, are you a bundler too?
In some cases, yes. I'm not a huge bundler, but in some cases where it made sense and helped me stand out from other people selling the exact same products I have.
Have you done any private label?
No.
Okay. Because it would seem that in that world that could be something to have a custom label. But again, you know, yarn is yarn, right?
No,
and I'm sure there's different types.
That's a different thing because I have to tell you, the crafts world is really brand conscious.
Oh, okay.
So you could say, oh, yeah, I'm just going to go to China and have some knitting needles made and put my brand on it. The time and money it would take to gain traction with those would be tremendous because knitters are knitting needle snobs. They're yarn snobs. They want the brand they want because that's the one they want. And I, knowing that, I don't want to spend the time and effort trying to build a brand.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Was it something that was transferred down to them from their family, or is it just because they get comfortable with it?
It's probably 99% of the time it's because that's what they're comfortable with.
Okay.
That may have been the first set of knitting needles they got, and they like the shape of the tips and the smoothness and all that kind of stuff, and they'll stick with that forever.
Now, is that your main category you tend to sell in?
I'm split between several. Actually, jewelry making tools is my big category. So everything from hammers to pliers to anvils to soldering equipment, all sorts of stuff like that. Knitting is... And spinning and weaving, I kind of lump those together because the people who do those kind of interchange between everything. That's my other big niche category.
Do you still enjoy working with those things yourself?
Every day.
Okay.
Every single day.
You get to do what you love and you get to sell it.
Exactly.
And,
that's a hard thing to do. You know, I think, you know, I know my husband loves photography. He was a professional photographer and spent 11 years traveling around the world taking pictures for a living, but selling photography things on Amazon is just not the place you want to be or the place he wants to be. You know, competing with the big boys in that field is just not viable.
Right. No. And people aren't looking for service. They're generally price conscious there. And that's all you have is your competition's
exactly.
price.
That's exactly right.
And I think they can buy a little better than you could in Jackson.
So.
So you are also a coach, and I want to get to that. But is that what you suggest when somebody's coming in? So somebody brand new is coming in, and they're like, you know, Charlene, I've been a, you know, think of something. I've been a cook, you know, or I had a kitchen store forever, and I love to cook, and I bake for everybody, and blah 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 blah. But I love it, but I can't make a living at it anymore. It's just gotten too competitive, and they're shutting me down, and this and that. How do you counsel that person when you start thinking about that?
You know, there are certain categories where I would have to say you almost have to throw in the towel, like the electronics category. I love electronics. I love technology, but it's not somewhere I'd want to sell. if you're not getting beat up on price, you're getting beat up with returns, you know? So
right.
That's, you may, depending on what your personal love and interest is, you may have to move outside that. And that's a hard thing for people to realize that, you know, I love this so much, but I can't make a living at it, you know?
Well, you're a pretty good example, though, of somebody who was doing something they love and was lucky, smart enough, however you want to say it, to get out of it, right? And yet you still have your toe in it. So there is life after brick and mortar, but as you're saying, you just have to be, you know, you exclude certain things. But in my kitchen example, would you steer them away from that?
Not necessarily, because there's a lot of niches in kitchen that you can get into. You're okay. Not going to compete selling KitchenAid mixers and in the big brand names, you know, Keurig coffee makers and all that, because Amazon can buy at a way better price than we can ever hope to buy. And Amazon's willing to make a penny or two on each thing, where we can't afford to do that. But if you find smaller areas within the kitchen cooking foodie area and make that your focus, an area that is too small for Amazon to want to take over but big enough for you to make a living at it, that could be a really viable business.
Hmm. Well, how did you get to be in the coaching business? It's interesting to me.
I've always loved teaching people stuff, and I spent many years – as part of that brick and mortar store, teaching.
Oh yeah, I guess you
would.
Yeah,
how to
sure.
make the stuff. And I traveled around the country, going to other stores who brought me in to teach there. You know, okay, you have this technique. We'll fly you here, and you stay for 3 days, and you can teach, you know, 10 or 15 of our customers this technique. That's how I really got into teaching, and it was just kind of a general progression as I got to deeper into the e-commerce thing and realized that I had a knack for helping people with it. It kind of evolved into the coaching.
Now, you're a wholesale buyer, right?
Yes.
You're not, well, we already determined there's no chance you're doing retail arm, you know, unless you're selling rocks, animals, you know, art. And I guess we could sell art, right? That could be something.
No retail arbitrage.
No retail. So you're a wholesale. Would you consider yourself a wholesale expert?
As much as you can say you're an expert, I would say I'm an expert within my niche, arts and crafts, and that extrapolates out to being very good at a whole bunch of them because the basics are the same. You know, the basics of buying low and selling high don't change depending on what niche you are. The thing I think everybody needs to learn in whatever their niche is you've got to learn the players. You know, so I may not know all the players in the kitchen niche, but I can learn them.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because you were just out at ASD. Now, you were speaking, you were coaching, you were probably buying, I would assume, right?
Actually, I wasn't buying at all because there's nothing there that fits my niche.
Okay, so there's nothing there.
Yeah.
Now, there's an event in Chicago this week, right?
Yeah, the Housewares show.
And that wouldn't be in your niche?
Nope. No.
Okay. So yours is pretty specific.
Yeah, there's specific shows that fit my niche, and they are targeted for people just like me. There's four of them that I'll be going to this year. So I went to ASD I didn't expect to find anything. I had some private clients who asked me to come to walk the show floor with them because they'd never been to a trade show, and help them with some negotiations they had with vendors and things like that.
Well, walk us through that. So that's the kind of coach you'll do, is some custom stuff like that when the opportunity exists. I mean, how far is Vegas from where you are?
It's two plane flights.
So it's not easy.
Here to Salt Lake City and then Salt Lake City to Vegas. So it's an all-day trip, you know, because the connections never seem to work out nicely. You know, you have four-hour layover. So it becomes an all-day trip. But these people who I coached, the private coaching at ASD, are part of my paid Facebook group. And they kind of banded together and said, we want you to come and help us. Here's what we'll do. And one of them hooked us up with a suite at the Venetian.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I mean, so they came through. It was pretty awesome. And I spent half a day with each of them. They all had different focus and interests and different things in their store. Some of them wanted help negotiating exclusive deals with a particular vendor. Others just had no idea what you even look for or what you even ask They'd never been to a show before. They had no idea where to start. So we had all sorts of different levels of people. And I have to say, I was just so blown away by how well they did.
So your group, wholesalesourcingexperts.com.
Right.
Correct. All right. I have no problem mentioning it. So you can accept people with no experience is what you're describing, or somebody who's a little seasoned who wants to get a little sharper. Is that what
exactly? We have every level in between. People going for the exclusive to people who have never bought wholesale before, who are transitioning from retail arbitrage into wholesale because their time is limited or their sourcing opportunities are limited or whatever reason, you know, that they want to move into a wholesale sourcing model, and that's where I help them.
Yeah, they can support their where they bought it, you know, all the things. They are approved vendors.
Right.
All those things. There's value in wholesale.
It's
ultimately
huge.
That's really where you got to go.
And I've been preaching this for years and years, probably 6 or 7 years on podcasts, that wholesale is the way to go. You know, the retail arbitrage is a great short-term play. But I think as Amazon becomes tougher and tougher on proving authenticity of products, if you can't prove that product, where you got it from the manufacturer or an authorized distributor, it could spell trouble for your account, you know, and enough complaints. And we know what Amazon does to you.
So walk me through. I'm a brand new person to wholesale, right? I've been doing retail arb, right? And I've had some success. But as you saying, you run out of product, right? You can find two of these or four of these, and they built up a little bit of cash. How does somebody get started? Where do you start them out at?
If they're going to trade show, it's one way. If they're not, it's another. If they're just at home and we're talking in the group about, I want to get started with this, I do start asking, what's your passion? What are your interests? What do you know? Because that can be a really good jumping off point. It may not be where they end up with their business, but at least it's a start. So say we have this person who is like loves cooking gadgets and all of that. Then we'll drill down a little bit about how much cash do you have to start, how much time do you have to spend sourcing, and we'll just get into the research of finding products.
Is the best I know the answer already. Is the best way to find products at trade shows, online, or both?
Both.
Okay,
both.
So it's both.
Yeah,
and I think in the old days, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the brick and mortar world, how did you find your products?
I found them through the old fashioned way, like phone books and directories, because those were pre-internet days. So we couldn't Google something to find a product. So there were trade directories that were put out every year that the library would have, and you'd look up those. You'd look up in consumer magazines and trade magazines. You'd find products that way.
And then you get a catalog, right?
Right. And then you get a catalog.
A printed catalog.
Yes, that's right. Yep. Yep. With a paper form you had to fill out and mail or fax it in, you know, the old fax in your order days. So it's changed quite a bit.
It really has. As a matter of fact, at ASD, I was buying something, and it was an older salesman who clearly came for that reason, whatever. And he's like, do you have a fax number? I'm like, I haven't had a fax number. I can't tell you when. It's been so long. It was just funny the way he said it. The son came over, Dad, nobody has a fax machine anymore. You know, it's just funny. You know, it's just so neat to see the generational difference. We all had a good laugh at it.
Yeah,
okay, so we got these people, and they're passionate in kitchen, and they're thinking about this, and they have a little bit of money. Do you advise people to come in with cash or credit? Because that's a big debate going on out there. I see that out there a lot.
I started with $100, and I'm debt. Oh, I hate debt. So you can guess my answer to that one.
Okay. So you're going to suggest, you're going to steer them. So, you know, let's think about this. If somebody wants to get in this business, you're going to steer them saying, hey, you've got to have some money you can afford to lose, right? You got to be able to, because there's not a fast turn with wholesale, right? Is that fair too?
It depends on the products, but it's not as fast as those hot toys in Q4. We can say that, you know, you're not going to sell 500 of your kitchen thing a day. Most likely, you know.
I always describe it as a pipeline. You fill the pipeline. It takes a while to fill the pipeline. But, boy, once it gets full and it gets chugging along, it just churns out
along.
The profits.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, the week I lost at ASD, I didn't ship or anything. But because I pushed and shipped hard before, and now I'm shipping again. I've not seen any slowdown in anything, you know. And
do you plan your vacations that way to know, hey, I'm going to be away? And I mean, you obviously just said that, but I'm going to ask it again. So you go on vacation, although where would you go on vacation from Jackson Hole, Wyoming? I don't know.
Our next trip is Bora Bora, just so
okay,
you know.
All right.
So,
well, that's fair. All right, that works. All right, that definitely works. So you know, how long are you going to be gone? And then you have to plan, right? Because, that's one of the cool things, too, is you have a history of the same product. It's very difficult when you get one Blue Paw Patrol and one Red Paw Patrol,
yeah,
and then they sell, and you're like, well,
where do I find
the blue
more?
One didn't sell, the red one did sell. How many do I order? Well, okay, right? But when you're selling silicone kitchen spatulas, right, and you've been selling five a day, guess what you're going to sell tomorrow, logically?
Probably five,
right? And if I'm going to be gone for 8 days, right,
you
want
to
keep minimum stock.
You need to ship 40 more in, you know?
Do you get that that depth in your course, in your I guess it's kind of a place where you can ask these kind of questions without feeling dumb, right?
Oh, yeah.
Is where they can say, you know, hey, I've been selling five a day. I'm going to be going away. How many should I put in there?
See, and my answer would actually be 45, because you don't want to be run out the day you get back from your trip, too. You need another day.
Right.
So.
Yeah, you can't process that day.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, in the group, nothing is off limits. That's why it's so great to have people of different levels. Because people will ask, I have no clue about this. Where do I start? You know, and other people say, well, I've been selling this product for 2 years, so I can anticipate in January, I'll sell about this many of them, you know. And the beauty of having, I say not hot products, because I don't have any of those hot products. I have a lot of steady products that are consistent month after month after month. There's no huge peak in Q4. They're just kind of these steady things. You have enough of those and it makes life really easy. You know, the whole reordering and all that kind of stuff becomes really easy.
You can plan,
yeah,
right? That's the,
yeah.
I think that's the best part, because it, one of the hardest things is not planning, right? You, if you're a retail arb, you have to go out and kill something and drag it home, as Dave Ramsey would say, right?
Yeah.
You have no choice, because, but if you're wholesale and you found a decent product, you can. Now, let me ask you that. How many SKUs do you carry generally?
About 2,200 at any one time. Okay. There,
so that's a lot.
Yeah, and I also, some fall off the other end as new ones come on. I've been at about that number for a couple of years now. Because sometimes products, the thrill is gone with them and nobody wants to do that particular craft again, so they're gone. But something else is in the pipeline that's become hot, you know. And
how many vendors would that be, roughly?
Oh, probably 10 regular vendors.
Okay, and, so that's manageable.
Yeah.
That piece is manageable.
And maybe 5 that are now and then vendors, you know.
In the wholesale model, and I'm going to keep beating this because I think people want to get there, and they just don't have the frame of reference to understand what it takes, right? When you're looking at your given week, you know, and I don't know if you work 5 days a week, 6 days a week, 7 days a week, 3 days a week, right? Can you walk us through kind of the strategy? I mean, are you placing your orders weekly with all 10 vendors? Or, you know, is it you trying to buy 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks at a time?
It depends on the vendor, because some of my stuff comes from overseas.
Okay.
None of it from China. Israel and India are my two big overseas vendors. And so those I order more at a time just to keep the shipping costs down. Though I have to admit, the India stuff comes freight free. So, you know.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. That, and it's in 2 days. I can get it, which I think is awesome.
Just think about that. Yeah, yeah. You can't even. Never mind. All right, go ahead.
And I can't get something from Salt Lake City in 2 days, you know. I can't get Amazon Prime in 2 days. It takes 3 days.
That's crazy.
As some of the vendors, I would say maybe one or two I order every week just because it's enough to keep it moving. Some of the others, the overseas one is about every 2 weeks. And some of the ones where the product doesn't move as fast, but it's got huge margins and sells for a lot of money, it may be once a month.
Okay. And do you have a calendar where you have this kind of marked down so you can plan that way, or you just know?
I just know. You know,
okay.
I watch my reports. I watch my inventory, not, you know, microscopically, But I can see by watching what Amazon has shipped notices just roughly where I am with stuff. And
well, you got 2,200 SKUs, though. That's a lot to watch.
Yeah, it doesn't seem overwhelming to me.
Okay.
For instance, the vendor in India, I probably carry 75 SKUs from them. They're all the same product in different designs.
Okay.
So that's pretty easy just to pop through their, you know, search by their name in my inventory list and boom, you know, place an order for them and be done. You know, I don't spend a ton of time reordering.
How much would you give me a week? Give me an approximation. Because that's a lot of SKUs and it's a lot of I mean, it's not that many vendors, but it is. And I think that's a good thing for people to get a frame of reference.
Max actual reorder time, probably 5 hours a week max.
Wow.
That's the beauty of wholesale. It beats racing around to a dozen Walmarts looking for stuff.
You know, and I'm a pretty large shoe seller. And so I love when a box of shoes comes in and open it up, pop the label on, close the box up, seal it back up and ship it in, you know, or I use a prep center too. And it just, to me, that's the beauty. I don't take stickers off.
No kidding. Yep.
No kidding. I don't have to bag things. Now, sometimes you do. I mean, you know, some places I bought things and there's two in a bag and I'm like, no, there should be one in a bag. And then you got to pull one out and put it in your own bag and that kind of thing.
A lot of my stuff I bag just because I've seen what happens to stuff in Amazon warehouses. And for the time it takes to bag, impulse seal, I would rather have it look spiffy for the customer than not. So I'm willing to take the time to do that.
Now, if somebody is thinking about, we're back to that kitchen person, right? And now they're a little more experienced, right? They've been selling retail arb and they want to now get into the wholesale game. What's the right way to transition? The logical, you know, I guess there's no easy way because if it was easy, everybody would be doing it, right? So, but there has to be a practical way to have a reasonable transition from one model to the next. Can you help us with that?
Well, the first one is don't go after the big fish and just take those out of your vision. Because
so give me an example in the kitchen world. What would you consider
that? KitchenAid is one. Okay. KitchenAid mixers, you know, those big names, Califon pots and pans, the big names that Amazon has wrapped up, just don't even go there. You are looking for the small niche products. Maybe you live in New Orleans and all the gadgets you need to cook gumbo, you know, that the big players may not think that that's a big enough niche, but you as a gumbo loving person know all the spices, know all the tools, know all that. That may be a place to start.
And so they start, you know, are they in the grocery store looking at the back of packages or are they trying to go to a trade show? What's the best way?
Boy, without spending any money, to me, the best thing to do is look locally first. So everything from your local phone directory to your local chamber of commerce has a list of local businesses. You may have a great small spice manufacturer in your town and not even know it.
Yeah, that's a great example.
Around, if you have an industrial park in your area, drive around and look for signs. There may be mom and pop spice market there, you know, that you see and, oh, yeah, maybe I could try that on Amazon because maybe nobody else has. So I like the smart start local thing first if it's possible and you live in an area with stuff. And that's research that doesn't cost you a lot of money. It's only time. You don't have to travel to a trade show.
What about the person who's selling, you know, they're selling toys, they're selling DVDs, books, whatever. They're selling anything they get their hand on because they love the buying and the selling. They really haven't figured out their niche and their why yet. How do you help them narrow down what they want to do?
Well, that's where it comes to, like, I start with asking, what do you love? What are you passionate about? You know, if you could do anything, what would you be doing? If somebody says cooking, then that's kind of a lead in that maybe they should be something like that. If somebody says, you know, working on computers, maybe not so much that niche, just because the margins aren't good and the returns can be difficult. So steering those interests to a niche that works, I think, is the biggest secret of all. And the thing that Deborah and I have talked about a bunch on the Thrifting for Profit podcast is that so many Amazon sellers think a niche is a category, meaning I can only sell in home or I can only sell in pets. Well, we both believe that a niche is far more than just a category. It can be a type, it can be a style, it can be a feel that spreads across many categories. So maybe if you're that person in New Orleans who loves cooking, you start with the kitchen stuff, but then maybe you move into other stuff that's related to the New Orleans lifestyle, you know, home decor things, clothing, all of that kind of stuff that still has that same general theme, but you aren't stuck in the kitchen category.
That's really smart. So your clients that you had out in and met out in ASD, were they reaching across categories? Because there was a huge variety of vendors. I was shocked at how many styles of vendors that were there.
That's a good way to put it. Styles of vendors. I like that.
Yeah, there was some interesting, there was some stuff to see. Yeah. And trying to be polite, you know, but I never saw so many liquidation sellers in my life. I've never seen so many people selling the same stuff. Booth next to booth next to booth next to booth. It really interests me. Now you know where it all comes from.
Yeah. I mean, and you could like skip by. For me, I'm not a liquidation person. If that's your niche, they were there. But for the average person, you can just get right by those and move on. You know, the vape section was also the area that was like, no.
I never saw that section. There were a couple buildings I never made it into because I'm like, I have no interest in there, you know. So how did, you know, were they able to reach across? I mean, is that one of the things? So I'm a seller and I'm having some success and I need to grow my business. Do I reach across the category? Is that one of the conversations you have? Steve, yeah. you're selling food, you're selling this, but look at what else you're missing because I have fresh eyes, right?
You have fresh eyes. Yeah, I think that's probably the most important thing people can take away is that a niche is not just a category in Amazon. Those categories are broad and arbitrary as far as I'm concerned. So going back to our New Orleans person, reach across to as many categories as you can that make sense to you. Because if they make sense to you as the store owner, and picture yourself having a brick and mortar store in the French Quarter, if this stuff makes sense to you in that brick and mortar that you're setting up in your mind, it'll make sense to pretty much anybody who's looking for those products. So the aprons that you're going to sell along with your spices and the wall signs for your porch and all of that, if they all make sense in a brick and mortar store, they're going to make sense on Amazon.
That's so good. Yeah, as you were describing that, I actually saw the brick and mortar with that whole layout, just as you described it, perfectly done. Wow. Okay, so you also you help people find profitable products, and so you know, walk me through where you take people, and you know, they're new to, they've never bought wholesale, right? They bought at Target, or they bought at Walmart, or they bought at, God forbid, a Kmart. And now they are trying to get into the wholesale world. You can help them find profitable products?
Well, the one thing I don't do is help them find specific products. I'm not a person who sells lists of products or does the research for people. That's where I've drawn the line.
I guess I should have added read and analyze vendor catalogs.
There you go.
That's what you said.
Yeah, that's far better. Yeah, if they want to go that far and post and ask questions about specific lines, product lines, we'll research margins. We'll research things like, you know, what would your inbound shipping cost be? Are these things oversized? Are they possibly hazmat? Do they have expiration dates? What kind of prep do they take, you know, on your end? The whole hassle factor is what I call that kind of stuff. When things like may seem really great and then you realize, you know, oh, this is such a pain to prep. You know, what was I thinking? We try to get everybody thinking about all those things as they're looking at a product catalog before they pull the trigger and make a purchase.
I love it. Because, you know, I think here's where I'm going to take this. What I see you doing is help people transition to a real business model. And I don't want to take away from the guys that are, I mean, I know multi-million dollar sellers at Retail Arb only. Man, these guys are crazy and they will crush us. They crush me every time they go out. And I get it. But to get to that sustainable long-term business model. That's what you're basically describing when you're describing, hey, I'm going to help you calculate profit margins and return on investment. Because if you're buying at Target, you're looking at a scan app and you're scanning it, says it's profitable, you're sending it in. That's pretty much your how much you really you're doing in the beginning. And we all have been there. So I'm not belittling anybody because I've been there. But now you're saying, hey, let's take a look at your product. Let's really look and see if it's profitable. By the time you ship it, you realize you got to ship it in. Oh, you realize you got to buy that bag. Oh, you realize that there's time involved.
That they're oversized, and all of a sudden that great margin just got eaten up in those oversized fees.
Oh, and you're going to have some returns. Oh, wait, what do you mean? And I'm going to have to eat those returns. Yeah, you got to build that into your model. Those are very good conversations, and I don't think a lot of people have them in the retail art business. I see a lot of people posting, as a matter of fact, where they say, hey, how do you make money in this? I just got my first payment from Amazon, and it's negative. And I'm like, oh, boy. Yeah, I get that. Yes. You know, we've all been there.
Yeah, it's a tough one for a lot of people to realize. And the thing about the wholesale that I've been preaching forever is that this is a business – that can grow beyond what I think you can do with retail arbitrage with the same level of time and energy put into it. Mm. I mean, I work 7 days a week because you have to answer emails on the weekends from Amazon. You know, you can't let those go. But I certainly don't work 8 hours a day.
Okay.
You know, it may look like it, but there's a lot of, you know, downtime in between it that you wouldn't be able to do at a normal job, you know. The dog has to go to the vet. Well, I can just go. You know, if the gym class is in right smack in the middle of the day, I can leave. You know, so I think the wholesale model is a way you can leverage your time to the most effective use in selling on Amazon.
And you sell as what you want to do, right? You could set your own levels at that point.
Right.
Once you find, you know, you just say, hey, you know what? I don't need this much money. I want to scale back. You can. Now, let me ask you this question, because I was thinking about that as you were talking. What, and you can't know a percentage, but generally, when most people come into your course, and they're probably coming from retail world, right? They were selling retail arb or whatever. What percentage of them become full-time wholesalers only and really maybe only go back to chase a hot toy just because Frozen Elsa's out there and they're walking past it, they can't turn it down. But generally speaking, they now have a wholesale business.
Of the active ones in the group, because you know there's people in a group that you never hear from,
mm-hmm.
and you hope they're getting something out of it but just aren't vocal. I am guessing of the ones who are active in the group, probably 80 to 90% move away from retail arbitrage into wholesale leave retail arbitrage behind, because they have found that they don't have to kill their bodies driving to store after store after store. They can sit home and reorder. You know, they can sit home and research products in a much deeper manner than you do when you're scanning at a Walmart, you know, unless you know those products, the games by heart or the toys by heart. So you can be go more into depth with your research too, because you don't have that weird pressure that comes from standing in the aisles of a store.
Hmm. What percentage of those 80%, right? So now we're going to do percentage of percentages. And that's very accurate, right? of what percentage of them are full-time now, would you say?
Oh, boy. I'm going to guess probably half.
Okay. So what I was trying to get to is that ultimately this is a real long-term business model, just like you see those little warehouses that you always go by, those industrial parks. You always wonder what they are. That's what they are, right? They're buying it wholesale. Generally, they're not manufacturers because not much is manufactured in the U.S. They're distributors or wholesalers, kind of the same thing, right, in some ways. And so they're buying products from somebody else made. They're bringing it in. They're packing it up and processing, doing whatever they do to get it ready, and they ship it out to some way, or they ship it to the customer. But generally, they ship it to hubs or something like that. That's what you see, is you're creating a long-term business model.
You took the words right out of my mouth, because that's what I say, that this, to me, is a long-term play. This is like this. I want this to be the last business I start, you know. I don't want to have to recreate the wheel with something else. So I'm trying to build it in such a way that it can continue on and grow as far as I want it to grow. I put certain limits on it for myself. I don't want a warehouse because I love working at home. I don't want employees because I don't love supervising people. It's not my strongest talent. So those two things are kind of self-limiting to the business. You know, you can only process what you can process in your house. And I don't want people coming in to help me process. So it's either, you know, prep service or send direct to Amazon, have them label, or the self-limiting thing. And that's a choice I made.
Well, the value of the self-limiting thing is it makes you make choices. I remember when I interviewed Dan Miller, and he used to say, Steve, I get rid of 10% of what I do every single year, even though it's profitable, because, you know, I just find it, you know, I just don't want to do it anymore. I'm looking forward to doing something else. So the beauty of what you're doing is, you know, if you find something that you want to add, more than likely you're going to have to stop doing something else. And that kind of forces you to look at things differently. And I think that's kind of healthy in some ways.
Yeah. Is that thing worth my time or money, or can I give it up so I can take this new thing on? Exactly.
And, you know, one more observation, and this is so obvious, but it needs to be said, is if the knitting needle market dropped out tomorrow, right? Mm-hmm. The knitting stopped and it was outlawed. You could quickly transition to the cooking market, to the, I don't know, beer making market.
Yep.
You can, anything else, because
sporting
the skill set.
Yep.
Yeah, sporting goods. Because the concept is the process, right? I saw Greg Murphy post something, and it was so smart. He's like, process is greater than talent. And I thought about it. All it was is process, and it had a little greater than and talent. And I thought to myself, you know what? He's dead right. Really, that process, which is what you're describing, it's so transferable. You could go into any niche.
Okay.
Now,
I'm
not saying you're going to know the details of that niche, but you could research it, and that was your point in the beginning of this conversation.
Right.
I
love it. You learn the sporting goods field. If knitting was outlawed and I couldn't sell knitting stuff, yeah, I would learn something else, because the ways of contacting wholesalers, of figuring margins, of getting products here, of processing products, of writing good Amazon listings, of taking photographs, those are transferable to any item you want to sell.
So Charlene is here to tell you that if this is a model that you really want to do, if you're really hoping to build, you know, there are people that are just trying to make the money as fast as they can so they can go and do something else, which I think is cool, because they realize this isn't what they want to do. They don't want to pack boxes or even buy things and sell it, right? They don't want to. That's a hassle.
As long as they realize that, then there's nothing wrong
with
it. Yeah.
I think that's cool, and they're using it to buy real estate or to do other ventures. I think that that's so admirable in a lot of ways, because I think that it is a means to that. But if you're looking for a long-term investable business, you know, wholesale and private label are probably the two models that are really sustainable. And private label is a challenge, but, you know, it's a lot of what you do is private label. That's that bundling thing. Andy Slamons always says that. He said bundling is private label. You know, when you're taking knitting needles, yarn, and I don't know what else. I've never knitted. Sorry about that. But whatever else you put together, that's private label. And that's the beauty of having wholesale accounts, because you can – buy from multiple vendors and put them together, correct?
Yeah, here's the thing about wholesale that people forget, and especially getting into wholesale now or a year from now. Pretty soon, every wholesaler is going to be represented on Amazon, right? Just kind of, you can take that as a general thing, because everybody wants to be on Amazon. So if you can build these relationships with these manufacturers sooner than later, meaning you beat the next guy to the punch, you're going to be ahead of the game, because I'm sure you heard it at ASD. I know many of the people I was with heard it, that, sorry, we have enough sellers on Amazon already.
Yep.
Right? So if you,
yeah, absolutely.
If you get in before everybody else does, you're ahead of the game.
It is that relationship issue.
Yep.
And, you know, and here's the other thing. There will be a continued consolidation of wholesalers, manufacturers, retailers, right? Oh, how many retail stores are we seeing close? So there will be a consolidation. So that account that said no to you before might become part of the company that you already have a deal with. And so all of a sudden, you now have this opportunity that doubles and triples because you were in on the ground floor. I agree with you. I think that's really smart.
I think it is something that is pretty much the only thing that adds value to your business, is those relationships. The inventory sells out and that's gone, you know, but those relationships you've built with the manufacturers, and especially if you can get Amazon exclusives where you're the only one that can sell those products on Amazon, that's where the value comes in with your business.
What personal habits you know, we're getting close to the end, and I want to make sure I don't miss these things. What personal habits would you say are the things that make you so successful? What things do you do, or what skills do you have that just, boom, that just roll for the model business you have?
I'm really organized. I think that's one of the things. You know, it's not that I'm hugely neat, though that's part of it, but it's just that I have a systems in place for dealing with different parts of the business. So organization is the first one. Second is I'm stubborn. So, you know, I don't want to give up. I just want to make it work, and I'll find a way, and that brings about thinking outside the box. If you're stubborn, okay, it's not going to work this way. How can I get this to work? You know, and you think of different ways to solve problems.
Love it. Love it. Love it.
Okay. So what are you using, internet tools that you just can't live without? Cause you're in the middle of nowhere. So you really have to rely on. Now, I'm sure you still get catalogs in the mail, right? There's still companies that send catalogs.
Yeah, a few. Uline is like the worst offender.
Oh, yeah, those are 5-pound books
every other week. Yeah.
Yeah.
And here we don't have mail delivery, so you have to go to the post office to pick up your mail in a P.O. box. So, you know, when one of those is shoved in there, there's no room for anything else.
The beauty is you can filter it right there, though. Yeah. There's always a recycling bin right there.
Right there. There's tons of them. Because you can imagine if nobody in town can get their mail delivered, how many boxes we have at our post office.
That's funny. So what other tools do you use?
Boy, the big one for me is Evernote. Mm. I love Evernote. I put everything I can into Evernote so I don't have to think about it. If it's in Evernote, I know it's there and I don't even have to think about it, because you can search Evernote a gazillion different ways to find things.
Is that linked to your phone and your desktop and everything?
Yep. My desktop, my laptop, my phone, my tablet, all of it syncs all the same way. And I love Evernote so much. They made me their first community leader. So in the online sales community and the craft community, I am the community leader for Evernote because I love it so much.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and it's free to use the basic version. So I think if anybody listening is not using it, try it. Just try it. And I think you will find it takes all those little bits and pieces that are floating around in your brain and just puts them somewhere that you know where they're at.
What, let me ask that then. What would be a best practice that somebody's using Evernote that most people aren't?
I use it for lots of little things. Like when I get a new prescription, I take a picture of the bottle. So then I always have that information. If I'm traveling and have to see a doctor, I can show me.
So you can store that image there?
Yeah, the image. You can store image. You can store videos. You can store spreadsheets, Word files, PDFs. You can make your own notes typed right into Evernote. My favorite thing to do with it is they have something called the Web Clipper that puts a little icon in your menu bar. It's an elephant, so you never forget. And like if I'm ordering from a supplier online and I get that final page that thank you for your order and it lists everything, if you just click on the little elephant, it saves it to Evernote. So you have a copy of your order right there the minute you did it. You don't have to worry about not getting an email confirmation, all that. You know exactly what you ordered. Mm-hmm. And you can do that with any web page. So travel confirmations, orders, pictures you want to save, anything you can save in Evernote. It's an awesome tool that I think is vastly underused.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to take another look at it. I know I've seen it in the past, and I just, for whatever reason, decided not to use it, but it sounds like it's much richer, too. Can you share things from Evernote with someone else?
You sure can. One of my coaching clients shares a notebook with me, and she makes notes throughout the week. We talk once every 2 weeks, and she makes notes about her business and questions and all that, and I can see it real time. And just see where she's going, what she's doing. And then when we have our call, we have all the information right there shared between us without even having to email each other.
So you can reply to what she had wrote.
Sure
so
can.
If I say, hey, what is the best wholesaler in blah, blah, blah category? You could say, well, here's five. So you can actually – and you could see that it's you writing and her writing separately?
Yep.
Oh, that's
Isn't
awesome.
That awesome.
I could see – well, I can just see partnerships, you know, and you're working with somebody. What a great, simple way to communicate, and it's right there. And the fact that you can do a video, you can do – spreadsheet or whatever. I mean, to me, that's valuable.
I taught a class in Evernote at the Craft and Hobby Association trade show last month, and it was class was just getting started with Evernote. And that was the biggest thing that people loved, is that collaboration thing, because a lot of them were business owners who lived in two different cities and had projects they were working on together. And the email kind of thing kind of gets out of hand. You know, you don't – this way – they could share all these in these Evernote notebooks and have everything in one place and not have to worry about missing anything.
Well, even Google Drive, I know you can share things in that, but it gets a little cumbersome sometimes because there's so much and back and forth. I love the idea of having just one little app where you can just,
yep.
And especially if it crosses your platform.
And syncs on all your devices, you know, which is wonderful.
Well, the goal of this podcast is to help people move forward, and I think the Evernote thing is going to help a lot of people move forward. I really think that's worth researching. But I love the wholesale discussion too, because again, I think that if you're only doing retail arb and you're thinking, can I sustain this? You know, do it for 6 months and then see if you get tired, you know, and let's see how you do. And when the, you know, when your significant other starts to say, where are you going again? You're going out again. You're going out again.
And you're covered with stickers from removing stickers off everything. And
it does get old,
yeah.
At some point. Now, maybe it might take you longer because you're younger than us and you can handle that. But at some point you're saying, what's the next possible model? Online arbitrage, great, great model. Again, though, you're getting onesies, twosies. And, you know, as I find is that you're running into credit card issues because if you're using a prep company, it's shipping somewhere else and you start to have hassles,
mm-hmm.
right? You want fewer hassles. With wholesale, you don't get those hassles. If people say no, you know, what's really cool, this is a great story, is at ASD, you know, the name of my podcast, E-Commerce Momentum, and that's the name of the business that was on my badge. It was such a great thing when I walk up and they read your name, right? They want to know where you're from. They immediately say e-commerce. It changed the discussion. There was no question. They knew I was going to talk about sell. Oh, you only sell online. Yep, that's right.
Yeah, don't be ashamed of it, because a lot of people are. They're like, I would be standing in a booth and people would come up and the vendor would say, you know, hi, how are you? What kind of store do you have? And they'd like online, like chin down, that cowery kind of body language. No, you've got to say, I have a great online store where we sell products and da 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 da, and be proud of it. Don't be embarrassed.
Yeah, well, the worst they're going to say is no.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you move on. Then there's a guy right next door.
And if you're good, you can turn the no into a yes.
Yeah. No, I agree with you, especially because when they tell you they've had a bad experience, that's the best time.
Isn't
to have that
it though? Because you can explain to them why you're different and what you will do to make their lives easier. Because that's what they want, right? They want to sell products and want it easier. So if you can explain how you're better than that guy who burned them, you may turn that no into a yes. I had a client who turned that no into a yes exclusive.
Yeah. Oh, I agree with you. If it's happened, well, I don't know if you're going to add more to that, because the goal was to help people move forward. I think you just gave me two really great things that people can move their business forward. Do you have any other tips or tricks that you can give us that you think that somebody can put in their business tomorrow?
When you're starting out, you have to treat it like a business. And that means all those things that go along with the business bank account, insurance, business credit card. Treat it seriously like a business. Get your EIN, register it with your state. You will find it far easier to deal with wholesalers when you have all those ducks ready to go when you contact them than to try to, like, I don't say fake it, but fake it, you know, like, oh, I don't have that registered, so I'll just pretend I do. Just do it. Do it right to start, and then you can go in with a lot more confidence.
Yeah, and that will separate you from most people.
Yep.
So I agree with you there. Okay, best way to get in touch with you. Now, I have wholesalesourcingexperts.com, and I'll have the link for that. Other way to get in touch with you?
That one works. There's a Contact Me button right there, and you can also find me on Facebook. I'm Charlene Anderson on Facebook in Jackson, Wyoming.
And I will have a link for that, too. I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you just got back, and you're back out relaxing. Now, you got great weather just like we have, and I'm so glad for that. I wish you nothing but continued success. I can't wait now. All the people who have been asking me to have you on, they can finally be satisfied.
I hope I didn't let them down.
Now I understand why. They're like, you got to meet her. You got to talk with her. I'm like, okay. And they were dead right. And I really appreciate you taking the time. I wish you nothing but a great year and a great next year, too.
And all the best to you. This was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Take care. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Very cool lady, very, very solid seller
very solid approach, and I just appreciate that. Remember, I'm not exaggerating. There are at least six people that ask me to get her on because they think that well of her, and they wanted to hear her, what she has to say, because they knew it would be solid. Coaching is not for everyone. You want to make sure that you and that coach are in the right place, that you both know where you are, know where you want to go, and that they have your best interest. If Charlene sounds like the right fit, reach out to her. Listen to the – I have a whole series of coaches coming up. Think about it and think through where you want to go. Can you get there on your own? Probably. All this information is out there on the internet for free. You can find it all. The question is, can you get to it all? Can you digest it all? Or can you use some help to get moving forward? Again, vet them, make sure that you're the right fit and that they have your interest and their heart too. It's really important. Thanks for listening. ecommercemomentum.com. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the e-commerce Momentum Podcast. All the links mentioned today can be found at ecommercemomentum.com under this episode number. Please remember to subscribe and like us on iTunes.